We have Professor Morgan, who is trained in constitutional law and political science in the Department of Public Law and Government at Columbia University, where he also taught before going to Harvard Law School in 1968 as a fellow in law and government there. He then went to Bowdoin in 1969, where his central professional interest has been the history, law, and politics of the First Amendment. He has written a number of books, including The Politics of Religious Conflict, The Supreme Court in Religion, and Domestic Intelligence, Monitoring Dissent in America. He has edited a number of other books and has contributed to a number of scholarly journals. He was involved in a study of the emerging right to know and was research director of a 20th Century Fund study of the CIA and FBI spying of American citizens from 1975 to 1979. In addition to his work on the First Amendment, he has written on the theoretical underpinning of the concept of due process of law. He was a co-author of the widely adopted textbooks American Politics, Direction of Change, Dynamics of Choice, and People, Power, and Politics. He has served as the chair of departments at various times. His most recent book is Disabling America, The Rights Industry in Our Time, and has written for Commentary and City Journal. Please welcome Dr. Morgan.
Good morning. I'd like to thank the Philadelphia Society for seeing fit to have me. My predecessors have done a beautiful job of laying out the historic relationship between religion and the public order in America. They have left it to me, of course, to address what went wrong. And what went wrong, of course, was the Supreme Court of the United States, as with so many other pathologies of our civic life today, the mistake was made in the Marble Palace. And I'd like to address this mistake of truly historic proportions in three ways. I'd like to make three points. First, how did it happen? Second, how did we figure out that it was wrong? And third, what thus far have we succeeded in doing about it? Scholars both of the left and the right are now more or less clear about the origins of the court's radically and inauthentically separationist reading of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. This is now in sharp focus. And particularly useful in sharpening this focus is a recent book, widely reviewed. Many of you, I'm sure, have read reviews of Lucas A. Poe Jr.'s The Warren Court in American Politics. This book is now being touted with some reason as the definitive study thus far of the Warren Court. And indeed, I think it is a marvelously revealing piece of work, largely unintentionally revealing. Poe begins by saying, I no longer concern myself with whether the decisions of the Warren Court, the great decisions of the 1960s, were right or wrong. I'm simply going to explain to you how they came about. Poe is both a law professor and a political scientist, suspect on two grounds. I'm just going to explain to you how these decisions came about. What he really means is, I've given up defending these constitutionally, historically, legally. I still love them. And I'm going to explain to you why you should love them, too. You should love them because they reflected the consensus of American elites in the finest period of our 20th century history. And indulge me in just a few quotes. I won't go on at length about this. But at the beginning of Poe's chapter on the Warren Court's religion decisions, he said, there was a dominant view, this is what moved the court, there was a dominant view shared by the well-educated, and therefore by the justices of the court, that religion was a private matter best left to the homes and churches. If religion was to have a public function at all, it was to promote social progress, such as supporting civil rights. And in the concluding paragraph of that chapter, he refers to the principal losers in the Warren Court's Establishment Clause jurisprudence, and refers to them as zealots, because their position was based on taking religion far more seriously and expansively than most Americans. The zealots were not amenable to compromise and persuasion. Therefore, they did not seem like reasonable people, and the justices were concerned that they could harm American politics. A hostility to religion in general, and not inconsiderable anti-Catholicism in particular. At another point in his chapter on the religion decisions, Poe observes that Justice Black, along with Justices Douglas and Warren, regarded anti-Catholicism as, quote, an acceptable and respectable prejudice. An acceptable and respectable prejudice. Anti-Catholicism is the anti-Semitism of the intellectuals. And while the Supreme Court of the 1960s was hardly made up of intellectuals, it was the intellectual class in America, the elites of the university, the media, and the legal profession, that the court cared about, that the justices cared about. This was their, if you will, relevant public. And the relevant public was hostile to religion. A brief personal digression here. Having spent so much of my life with the politics of the Establishment Clause, it is remarkable the extent to which the historical understanding, the bogus historical understanding, as Graham Walker has pointed out, that it was foisted upon us by the Warren Court, had its roots in American anti-Catholicism. The pre-Warren Court case, which carelessly and incoherently applied the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment to the states, which of course you can't do, but you know, we're the Supreme Court, we can do it. That case, Everson versus the Board of Education of Ewing, New Jersey, was brought by an unsavory old character named Arch A. Everson. And Arch A. Everson, believe it or not, was a member of the American Order of United Mechanics, a nativist organization that had survived through to the post-World War II period from the know-nothing period preceding the Civil War. Much of the rhetoric and grammar of strict separation was worked out toward the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century in that great recrudescence of American nativism manifested by the rise of the American Protective Association. Sharpen the point still further, Justice Black, who, of course, was on the court, the author of the two principal texts that got the Establishment Clause wrong. One was Everson in 47, the other was the school prayer case in 1962. Justice Black learned his separationism in the Ku Klux Klan. His most recent biographer, Roger Newman, is altogether clear about this. Black was not some kind of casual member, you know, who just joined the Klan because that was all expected. That was expected of all Alabama politicians of his time. As one of his fellow Klansmen of the period remarked, Hugo could always be counted on for a good anti-papist tirade. Now, Black, of course, had repented the racism and the nativism of the Klan, I think genuinely, when he came to the court. But what remained was this spurious history of strict separation, a history that relied on a misunderstanding, I think, of the great controversy in Virginia, pre-constitutional controversy over the Virginia Subsidy Bill, where it was proposed that the salaries of ministers of religion in Virginia be supported. James Madison fought it. It was the occasion of his great memorial and remonstrance to his fellow legislators in Virginia. And then, of course, that mischievous letter to the Danbury Baptists in 1803. I won't engage in a reprise of that. Graham Walker has done it beautifully, except to say that the letter itself, of course, we now know, was political cover. Jefferson was taking intense political heat for his refusal to issue a Thanksgiving proclamation. And the letter to the Danbury Baptists was a way of saying, not me. Oh, no, this is not my choice. This is enjoined by the Constitution of the United States. Okay, so what we have is a reading of the Establishment Clause that had its roots in hostility to religion and not a little anti-Catholicism, but was expressed and justified with a history that I think can fairly be called spurious. At least it is a history gravely distorted. These infirm, now I'm moving on to point two. I'm gonna move faster here. The infirm historical foundations of this strict separationist theory were thoroughly exposed in the late by the late 1970s and the 1980s. 1970s and 1980s saw scholarly works appearing saying, no, this simply wasn't the way it was. The strict separationist history had Virginia wrong. After all, what was being debated in Virginia was an actual subsidy to ministers of religion. That's quite irrelevant to the kinds of issues that we're concerned about today, that is, the participation of faith-based institutions in delivering public service, the participation of faith-based institutions in our civic life. Quite different issues. The absurdity of attempting to apply to the states a provision that was in substantial part intended to protect the states from national intermeddling with their arrangements with respect to religion and the public order, that was also thoroughly exposed. And all this revisionism was registered within the court in then Justice Rehnquist's powerful and famous dissent in Wallace versus Jaffray in 1985. Ever since that dissent, the old Justice Black history has been on the run. That doesn't mean that it's without defenders. For reasons that are altogether unclear to me, David Souter has drunk deeply of that old potion and is quite inebriated by it. But both among scholars, Graham Walker mentioned Akhil Lamar, a rip-roaring law professor at Yale, complete secularist, no interest in religious issues, and Amar essentially agrees with commentators from the right. So the old history is on the run. The question then becomes, now I can move to point three, what have we succeeded in doing about it? Now, it's one thing put in place a revisionist scholarship and to attract members, justices of the Supreme Court, to that scholarship. But what we find is that the court as a whole is very difficult to move in this respect. That is, the center of the contemporary Supreme Court, Justices Kennedy and and O'Connor, both understand that the old separationist history is inadequate. But what they have done is to erect for themselves a kind of jerry-built alternative to the old spurious separationist history. So that our present configuration, crudely speaking, is that at least two members of the court and probably three still hew to the old mistaken history. The three members of the court have certainly jettisoned it completely and have been calling upon their fellows to follow. Two crucial votes in the center of the court have abandoned the history without abandoning the doctrine. Their opinions, I'm speaking of O'Connor and Kennedy, are replete with references to not the Constitution, but our decisions. The decisions of this court. In their thinking, the Constitution disappears. They do not defend the old black historical mistake. What they do is insist on the continuing of the doctrine based on a new an intriguing constitutional theory. And that constitutional theory is that somewhere embedded in the Constitution, they're never quite clear where, is a right to be free of discomfort in a public place by any mention of the deity. A right not to be discomforted. And that is the reason that there has been no progress on the court with respect to what I call the prayer branch of Establishment Clause jurisprudence. That is, our public ceremonies remain, by order of the Supreme Court, ruthlessly secularized. And no progress there. The other branch of Establishment Clause doctrine, the participation of faith-based institutions in public programs of one sort or another, we have made some, it's been painful, but we have made some progress. We saw that last spring in the New Orleans case where, albeit a very divided Supreme Court, allowed for computers to be placed at public expense in church-related schools. So there's an exquisite balance on the court right now. Some more constitutional elbow room has been provided for faith-based institutions, but it is very delicate. It can be rolled back by one or two nominations to the court. So here's the dilemma. Lincoln said, "We must take men whose opinions are known." But how difficult it will be for George W. Bush, in the best case analysis, to take people whose opinions are known, with the Senate divided 50-50. If we are not to lose the small, hard-won gains of the last decade and a half, it will require, again, best case analysis of President Bush, the courage of a lion and the guile of a fox.